1970s, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson comes under fresh criticism amid revelations about his plea for funds from a conservative donor. Iran says any agreement in the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 deal must include guarantees that no new sanctions will be imposed on Tehran once they are removed. Also in the headline, Kazakhstan's president says order has been mainly restored across the country following days of violent protests triggered by a spike in fuel prices. Those were the top stories here in Tehran. Welcome. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is under fire for seeking funds from a conservative donor to refurbish his Downing Street flat. The Premier has sought the money while promising to consider plans for a great exhibition. Johnson is accused of corruption after his text messages with donor David Brownlow were released. The Premier has apologized for the texts not being given to his independent ethics advisor during an initial inquiry last spring. That inquiry probed the revamp funding estimated to have cost £112,000. Last month, Johnson faced widespread criticism after revelations that parties had been held at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns in 2020. The scandal caused the approval ratings of the British Premier and his ruling party to decline sharply. Johnson has faced calls to step down even from within his own party. A group of British lawmakers have warned of a dangerous precedent being set after protesters who toppled the statue of 17th century slave trader Edward Colstone walked free from a British court, cleared of criminal damage charges. The supporters of the people dubbed the Colstone Four says the case was politically motivated and should never have been brought in the first place. Amina Taylor explains.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Scoos, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history. Daylight. We illuminated history.
And this is the victory for Bristol. This is the victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General, asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Tehran says it wants guarantees that new sanctions will not be imposed on Iran as the country continues talks with the remaining parties to the 2015 deal. The Iranian foreign minister says
His country demands removal of all sanctions imposed after the U.S. withdrew from the agreement known as the JCPOA. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Hossein Amir Abdullahian declared Iran wants assurances that it will be able to export oil and access its revenues. He said the ongoing negotiations in Vienna between Iran and the P4 plus one are moving forward in the right direction. He said a good agreement can be reached in the talks if the Western negotiators show determination. France strikes a positive tone over the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal known as the JCPOA. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian says progress has been made in the last few days. Le Drian says he remains convinced that parties to the talks can reach a deal. However, he says time is running out. Earlier this week, the U.S. also said the negotiations in Vienna had shown modest progress. The negotiations are taking place between Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, Germany, and the EU. The U.S. is taking part indirectly. It withdrew from the accord in 2018, reinstating sanctions on Iran. The Vienna talks, now in their eighth round, aim to remove the sanctions in what Iran says should be a verifiable manner. Tehran also says Washington should provide guarantees that it will not pull out again. We spoke to political commentator Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh. He says Iran's new initiatives in the Vienna talks have turned the tide, making the country play a more active role.
It was really surprising, or at least interesting to me, when the new Iranian administration and team, led by Dr. Ali Bagheri Kani, when they took the initiative and became the active actor and party in the talks, and for the first time ever in the past decade, or at least in the past 8 years, I saw the Western countries to become passive and to become reactive and to be forced to react to the Iranian initiative and actions. That was very important to me. But, you know, that means that you set the rules, you set the goal, the conditions, everything is under your control. The other parties have been, you know, forced to show reaction. But this reaction was wild at the beginning, as I said. They started playing game, but they were forced to show some kind of rational reaction. But this is for this stage. For the time being, I don't think that Americans and Europeans are really ready to do the right thing and to reciprocate Iran's good intentions. We need to wait and see what happens in the next week or in maximum 2 weeks from now, when vital, you know, things and issues would go under discussion. For the time being, there are indications to me that Americans and Europeans are still playing a game of theatrical games.
New comments by the U.S. and Japan about China's policies draw an angry reaction from Beijing. China now says it has lodged a formal complaint with both states. Foreign and defense ministers of the U.S. and Japan, in their latest meeting, voiced concern about China's growing might. They said Beijing's efforts to undermine the rules-based order present challenges to the region and the whole world. Japan and the U.S. pledged to work together to deter if necessary, that is, respond to what they called destabilizing activities in the region. The U.S. and its regional allies are at odds with China over a series of issues, including Taiwan. China says Taiwan is part of its territory and is opposed to the U.S.'s military support for the island. Kazakhstan began the new year with a spike in fuel prices that triggered protests across the country. Now, President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev says constitutional order has been mainly restored, but an ongoing operation will continue against what he calls terrorists.
The counter-terrorist operation continues. The militants have not laid down their arms, they continue to commit crimes or are preparing for them. The fight against them must be pursued to the end. Whoever does not surrender will be destroyed.
Tokayev says he's ordered security forces to open fire without warning in case of further unrest. He says up to 20,000 bandits have attacked the main city of Almaty, where they destroyed state property. Protests in Almaty and other Kazakh cities turned violent this week with clashes between protesters and security forces. The government says 44 people were killed. They included security forces and people whom the government called armed criminals. Thousands more were arrested. A regional peacekeeping force led by Russia is now in Kazakhstan to help it restore security. Political commentator Mr. Andrei Kortonov believes that the fuel price hike in Kazakhstan acted as a catalyst to spark unrest in the absence of political reforms there. Take a listen.
Gas prices were a catalyst rather than the main reason for the protests. I think that what happened in Kazakhstan is that especially after the political transition was announced in June of 2019, there were many expectations that things would get better for ordinary people, but the opposite has happened, especially due to the COVID crisis. But the authorities were also very slow in the reforms that they promised. There were many procrastinations, and definitely this hybrid system of political transition was not very helpful in raising the efficiency of the economic performance of the country. So this discontent was simmering.
In other news, COVID cases keep surging in India, where new daily infections hit a seven-month high. The country on Friday reported over 117,000 new cases, taking the total to more than 35 million. The rise in cases is driven by the Omicron variant, which is overtaking Delta. Last spring, Delta caused a surge that resulted in thousands of deaths each day. Now, experts worry that the current surge could again see hospitals overwhelmed. Authorities in several Indian cities have already brought in restrictions to keep infections in check. The capital, New Delhi, is under an overnight curfew. It'll impose further restrictions for weekend later on Friday. India's total COVID deaths are above 483,000. A correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says India needs stricter measures to tackle its ongoing wave of COVID infections.
There is again a problem with the mindset and the imagination that people are taking things for granted and things are being taken easily, despite and regardless of the fact that April was the deadliest. Last April, the country saw a deadliest period in its history. So there are many guidelines in place. There are many health emergencies and health protocols that have been decided and also put in place. But they need more stringent measures, like we see in the public transport. People are overcrowding the buses. They are flouting all the protocols and guidelines. People are not wearing masks just to keep them on their chins. And the basic protocol is missing. So there's a lot to do.
2 years into the COVID pandemic, global cases surpassed 300 million with related deaths at 5.5 million. That's according to the U.S.-based Johns Hopkins University. It says the U.S. has logged over 58 million infections and almost 834,000 fatalities, both by far the largest in the world. The country now accounts for over 19% of global COVID cases and 15% of related deaths. In Europe, the worst-hit country is Britain, with more than 150,000 deaths and 14 million infections. COVID has had numerous mutations since it emerged in China in December of 2019. Its latest variant, Omicron, has increased infections in recent weeks and caused the first death in Brazil. The World Health Organization has warned against underestimating the impact of Omicron. It says the rapid and high number of infections is overwhelming health systems around the world. Now, the eastern United States is bracing for the second major winter storm in 5 days, with a leading forecasting service warning of a bomb cyclone. Cyclone is the first of its kind to hit the eastern U.S. in 2022, affecting regions from Tennessee to New York. It brings heavy snow and powerful winds. The heaviest snow is forecast for Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. Earlier this week, the U.S. Southeast and Mid-Atlantic were hit by a winter storm. It forced schools to close and airports to cancel flights while knocking out power for thousands of people. Authorities have urged people to only travel if necessary. The democracy that the U.S. claims to be its flag bearer took a huge blow when protesters claiming the election had been stolen stormed the Capitol building. Now, with the first anniversary of the insurrection here, the U.S. is again finding itself on shaky ground. Far-right and alternative groups to extreme politicians in the Republican Party have been inciting divisions in the country. And now, a new report warning of the rising threat of extremism in the U.S. shows why the government needs to be very concerned.
A new report has warned about the rising threat of extremism in the United States. The report has been prepared by the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. It says that 12 months after the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob, far-right groups were traced and arrested by police and federal authorities. But it says other groups have reorganized, often with an emphasis on local-level politics. It found that domestic extremist groups have recruited and spread their messages through culture war debates, including vaccines, race, and education. It says groups such as Proud Boys and QAnon conspiracy movement have re-emerged in recent months. They have made progress by shifting to alternative online platforms, embracing rhetoric to engage more broadly with the mainstream conservative base and engaging in new political activities, particularly public health and education issues at the local level. The report says extremist movements were filled with paranoia following the Capitol riot. It notes that members are suspicious of each other and law enforcement. That has discouraged many members from attending public events.
And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
He was assassinated in 2020. But Qasem Soleimani's legacy continues and has been kept alive via regional operations, in hearts and minds of Muslims, and by days of TV broadcasts in the run-up to his two-year anniversary. Known for piety and courage, even his enemies had a good word to put in for him. Enemies such as Israel and America, to whom he was a thorn in the side in West Asia. Media on the martyr and the resistance includes an exhibition at Tehran's Holy Defense Museum with lifelike models of warplanes and ships and the like, and a wax effigy of the general I could have sworn was alive as I looked on, waiting for the crew to set up camera. What triggered Soleimani's resistance-related legacy was the 1980s eight-year Iraq-Iran war, in which Iraq received every support imaginable from America and an American-led world. To Haj Qasem, it was enough is enough. We are not taking one more battering from America or its lackeys. For more on the man and his mission, stay with me, Leila Faramazi, on Iran Today, on the occasion of the second anniversary of an assassination. Along his way, Soleimani set his sights on the day the United States of America is expelled from this region. In fighting terror groups created or propped up by the U.S., funny thing is, Soleimani's death was no less effective in weakening the American position and grip in West Asia than his will in life. Soleimani was shot together with nine others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy head of Hashd al-Shaabi. That's Iraq's popular mobilization forces. The incident 2 years ago happened as the Iranian general was visiting Iraq at the invitation of Iraq's government to deliver an Iranian reply to a Saudi message through Iraq. The U.S. broke all sorts of laws and agreements by this act of assassination. And just 2 days later, on January the 5th, Iraq's parliament voted to expel U.S. military forces from Iraq, with parliamentarians chanting, "Yes, yes, Soleimani." Mr. Akbari, himself a general, shared with us his outlook to put into perspective General Soleimani's approaches and methods.
We believe that although martyrdom indeed means a great person is gone, the effects that they have on society and the environment around them are positive. The examples are Ashura and Karbala, when they thought that with the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions and imprisonment of their families, everything including Islam was over. But that was the very time when Islam was revived. Maybe if that hadn't happened, Islam would have perished. If Imam Hussein was to surrender, Islam would be over. Many thought that the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani would mean the end of many things. The Americans believed they would consolidate their power in Iraq. After the martyrdom of Haj Qasem, we are witnessing a series of events. The U.S. decided to leave Iraq, and the resistance persisted, which now means Americans have to leave.
On the 8th of January, a day after his funeral procession, Iran retaliated with a major missile attack on the Ain al-Assad and another Iraqi base where U.S. troops were stationed. It was called Operation Martyr Soleimani. Iran's showering the U.S. Ain al-Assad airbase in Iraq's western governorate of Al-Anbar with tens of ground-to-ground missiles left more than 100 U.S. service members with traumatic brain injury, TBI. The assassination was ordered by former U.S. President Trump. He had reportedly mulled over the idea of removing Soleimani simply over a game of golf, having been motivated by his Foreign Secretary Pompeo's unbacked speculations. Speculations of Soleimani being a danger to American lives. Following its retaliatory response, Iran announced the new strategy of continuing what General Soleimani had assiduously started, the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region. That would be the real revenge. Some 2 years later, in a statement on the second anniversary of the Soleimani assassination, this is what the Iranian Foreign Ministry said. The prompt and effective action of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran in slapping the American troops stationed at the Ain al-Assad base in Iraq in the face along with the spiritual effects of the blood of Iranian and Iraqi martyrs, upset the equations and brought about the failure of U.S. regional strategy. The U.S. fleeing from Afghanistan, the beginning of the process of withdrawal from Iraq, and the change in the strategy of the U.S. military presence in the geostrategic region of Persian Gulf showcase a small part of such impacts and consequences. The Foreign Ministry added, "Undoubtedly, the criminal act of the United States in martyring General Soleimani is a clear manifestation of a terrorist attack that was orchestrated and carried out in an organized manner by the then U.S. government, for which the White House is now responsible." Now, Iran and Iraq have formed a joint judicial committee to bring to justice the perpetrators behind the assassination. Countries other than the United States were also involved in the act of state terrorism, according to the Secretary of Iran's Judiciary's Human Rights Council, Qasem Gharibabadi. Mr. Shirazi was a brother-at-arms to Qasem Soleimani, so we traveled from west to east of Tehran metropolis to hear it from someone in the know.
The President of the United States personally decided to assassinate him. Trump was Haji Qasem's opponent. The world-renowned commander was more popular amongst the armed forces than any other commander. He was more popular than any political figure in Iran except for the leader of the Islamic Revolution. It would be very natural for such a person to lose all humility. But when his mother passed away, she passed away before his father. I was there for a funeral in Ghanat Malik. They were setting up security gates to check people who wanted to attend the funeral. When Haji Qasem realized that, he came to the gates saying that people who are there to give their condolences should not get into trouble and removed all the gates. He did the same in Kerman and Tehran for his father's funeral. People would go visit him, especially when he went to Kerman. The people of Kerman knew him for 50 years. He was always tired whenever he returned from Kerman. He'd say people would go to him with their problems until late at night. If he didn't help them, who else would?
Iran submitted a 300-page document on the Soleimani assassination to Iraq, and Iran and Iraq issued a joint statement on December the 25th, according to which both countries insisted the terror attack on the general and companions was a violation of international law, including conventions on countering terrorism, and so it carries international responsibility. The third joint research committee on the assassination is going to be held in Baghdad by early to mid-February. To attend more to background on the making of the man and what set him on his mission, Soleimani was just a youngster with no more than a high school diploma at the time of the Iraq-Iran war. But he joined the front and quickly rose in the ranks, and in 1998, he became head of the Quds Force with its extraterritorial operations.
Haji Qasem was a military training instructor when he joined the IRGC. Later, he was sent to the front in Operation Sam al-Amir and Tariq al-Quds. He was a battalion member and not a commander yet. Before Operation Fat al-Mubin, he was chosen as the commander of the Sarallah Brigade. He also participated in Operation Beit al-Muqaddas in 1982. He then became the commander of the Sarallah Brigade, which was expanded after the war ended, turning into the 7th Division of Sahab-e-Zaman. Back then, I was in charge of the division's PR. I was a deputy of the cultural affairs of the 7th Division. After the war ended, Qasem Soleimani came to Kerman and stayed there. He then became the commander of the Quds forces of the IRGC.
General Soleimani's popularity was basically down to his personality, his selfless courage on the battlefront, as well as his tactical military mind applied to complex geostrategic situations in the field, especially in fighting the nightmare terror group Daesh or ISIS.
He said he would sacrifice his life for the people thousands of times. He wasn't joking. We saw him in action in Syria, where he'd personally go to where the operation had to take place for reconnaissance. Sometimes the intelligence unit has to approach the enemy's line, infiltrate, and do the reckon work. Haji Qasem would personally get there to ensure he was protecting the lives of the youth whose lives their parents entrusted to him. He would go places he didn't allow the commanders to go. I witnessed that several times in Iraq and Syria. the commanders would complain that they weren't allowed to go. He put his life on the line so his commanders and troops stay safe. He had a loving attitude towards his forces and the people. It's only natural for the people to love him back. His martyrdom hurt the whole country.
Iranian and Iranian-backed forces became major combatants against Daesh after that group took over roughly a third of Iraq in 2014. The conflict went on till 2017. Soleimani was an egalitarian who avoided superior versus inferior relationships at work. But he was a natural-born leader as well, deducing from all one reads and hears. He was always in to fight for a cause and grouped people to go along with him. He was instrumental in preventing Iraq from completely falling to ISIS or Daesh, fighting with his Quds force and Iranian-backed Iraqi militia forces and regular forces. General Mojahedi was brother-in-arms to Haj Qasem. He draws parallels on tactics he's seen his fellow general apply. We got to meet him at Valfaj, an IRGC housing complex.
We need to define strategic depth for ourselves and be sure from outside the borders that we will act immediately if someone makes a move. Well, in the last few years, the Americans came to the region and overthrew the governments in Afghanistan and Iraq and stayed there. All our officials and people know that they weren't only there to occupy the two countries. They were there to harass us and check our moves. Their next move would be against us. Qasem Soleimani took action against that. He mobilized people with a jihadi attitude and prepared and organized them to defend the country. He put people within six countries in line to fight.
Kurdish leaders have been cited that when Daesh took Mosul in 2014 and was about to head for Erbil, there was no American or Turkish support in sight for the Kurdish forces. But in just 2 hours, Soleimani arrived in Erbil with two large planes of military supplies. His presence alone was a battle shipment. He got to shore up the frontline Peshmerga soldiers to protect Erbil and Kirkuk from the Daesh onslaught. And protected they were.
Haj Qasem was in contact with all the fighters in the world for 22 years. He was in touch with all the clerics of the world. A character like Haj Qasem doesn't make empty swears. In a speech in 2010 at the Khanuk Martis Congress, he said, "By God, I know all the Shia clergy. I had a meeting with them all." He affected them. His words were influential. You see, some warring parties in the region were friendly to Qasem Soleimani and would listen to him. He would bring them to Iran or go to their respective countries to hold meetings. Naturally, a 40-year-old friendship would link them all together. In critical times in Iraq, you could see that everyone showed up and was present on the field.
Also in the south of Iraq, where that country's forces had collapsed with Daesh at the gates in Baghdad and Najaf, Soleimani organized Shia militias with a fatwa from Ayatollah Sistani, and he conducted his commands to the effect needed in pushing back Daesh. And pushed back Daesh was.
He believed that Iranians are Shia Muslims and believed in the Islamic revolution and the Islamic figures before taking any political beliefs and belonging to any camps. He believed that the inherent opportunities of the Iranian people's traditional beliefs shouldn't be sacrificed for the political matters that aren't that relevant anyway, as they are limited to the times before elections, after which everything goes back to where it was. In practice, there is no party system by the specific definition here, as both political camps believe in the Islamic figures and the fight against Israel. Their commonalities are much more than their differences. Their differences mostly lie in who takes power and wins the elections than in core issues.
There's plenty been said on the matter and the man in many different voices and media outlets. Let's take a look at some of those sources with Mohammed.
I'm Mohammed Gourd, and welcome to this episode's news section. The world is marking the anniversary of the assassination of Iranian top military commander General Qasem Soleimani. He was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike on the 3rd of January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport. But his assassination, which many legal experts have branded as an extrajudicial murder, is still drawing criticism from around the world, even 2 years after the incident. In this episode, we are going to be taking a look at what some news outlets have to say on the matter. First, we have the Kashmir Observer reporting that Trump tops the blacklist of perpetrators of the Soleimani assassination, according to Iranian officials. The Secretary General of Iran's Human Rights Office says three countries inside the region and three outside were involved in the 2020 assassination of Iran's top anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani, with former U.S. President Donald Trump topping the list of criminals behind the terrorist attack. In remarks on December 29, 2021, Kazem Gharibabadi pointed out that because the assassination was conducted by the U.S. government, most of the perpetrators are American. Gharibabadi explained that more than 120 perpetrators have been identified, arrest warrants have been issued for more than 40, and judicial representatives have been sent to 9 countries for pursuing the case. According to Gharibabadi, the trial of the perpetrators will be held in 2 months. An article published on the J-Post is reporting that the ex-IDF chief says Israel was involved in the Soleimani assassination. The article states that this is the first time a top Israeli official has confirmed a role in the operation in 2020 to assassinate Iran's top commander Qasem Soleimani. According to the report, the former head of the IDF's military intelligence has confirmed Israel played a role in the assassination of Iran's commander to the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, Quds Force General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020. Though Israel had been rumored to have shared intelligence regarding Soleimani's location to the U.S. for the targeted killing, it was the first time a top Israeli military officer confirmed Israel's role in the operation. In May 2021, it was reported that Israel had shared three of his cell phone numbers with the U.S. hours before the drone strike at Baghdad airport. Tasnim News also touched on the matter by releasing a report titled by the Venezuelan president's statement, which reads, "The world must raise voice in condemnation of General Soleimani's assassination." Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said the international community must raise its voice in condemnation of the assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani. After voicing his admiration for Iranian leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and describing him as a man of great wisdom and great intelligence, the Venezuelan president also revealed that the former commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Force, General Qasem Soleimani, visited Venezuela between March and April 2019. The Venezuelan president praised General Soleimani's bravery and courage in standing against global terrorism and said, "He was a smiley, optimistic man, and I thank God for ever meeting him." Soleimani combated terrorism and the brutal terrorist criminals who attacked the peoples of the Axis of Resistance. "He was a brave man," the Venezuelan president added. He stressed the importance of learning from horrific crimes, such as the crime of assassinating General Soleimani. "Is this a world we want, where we witness the White House issuing an order to kill a hero of the struggle against terrorism in Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Lebanon?" He underscored that the world must raise its voice again in condemnation of the murder of the people's hero, General Soleimani. Thanks for joining me in this episode's news section. And now, back to Leila.
Soleimani was the military genius who shattered the Israeli image of invincibility. That happened during the 33-day-long War of Tammuz in 2006 between the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, and the Zionist entity. The war was part of the then-US President George W. Bush's plan to destroy the resistance in Palestine and Lebanon and to topple the government in Syria after having invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. It was all part of a broader plan intended to finally isolate and encircle Iran. Who went to Beirut in the early days of the Israeli attack on Lebanon was Qasem Soleimani. He did so to organize the resistance forces and coordinate combat operations.
Haj Qasem accomplished some fundamental work in his lifetime. He strived to make the resistance self-sufficient, meaning that everyone would achieve an innate ability based on their specific geographical conditions. He didn't need anyone to assist him or send him equipment. The second issue was that he believed popular support played a major role in the success of the resistance movement, or at least helped it move in the course of success. His reliance on the people as an effective component of the indicators of power, in my opinion, was the second important thing he's done. His third contribution was that the resistance can stand against the enemy and win in an asymmetric war. He saw that in the 33-day war, the war on Gaza, the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and others. We saw that whenever the resistance had roots in the people, the United States suffered defeats.
Thanks to Soleimani and the troops he commanded or joined forces with, Daesh was defeated in, yes, Iraq and most parts of Syria.
Haj Qasem tried to create a regional unity between the resistance forces with his special worldview. During the Syrian conflict, fighters from different regions, Hezbollah, Iraq, Fatemiyoun, Zainabiyoun and others came to help. The support isn't mere armaments and weaponry and technology, but the whole Muslim community comes to the help. Such comprehensive support strengthens the resistance and weakens the enemy.
Without strategy and pragmatism, a fight against the likes of Daesh would have been futile. Fighting Daesh had several dimensions, such as being on the front lines with Iraqi and Syrian fighters, regular and accurate command in the fight against Daesh, dealing with foreign powers and good and coordinated cooperation with Iraqi, Syrian or Russian commanders in the fight against Daesh, and foiling U.S. plans in transferring Daesh forces to operational areas by identifying front lines. This makes it a valid point that the U.S. must have assassinated Soleimani and company when it did, mostly just as a distraction from Donald Trump's impeachment by Senate. On the life and legacy of Haj Qasem, this is what our guest said.
In my opinion, Qasem Soleimani's military life is divided into three historical periods. The first was during the Iraq-Iran War, the second was his fight against counter-revolution and traffickers in Iran's southeast. The most important period of his life was when he entered the field of resistance.
Well, as you might know, the southeast of the country was an unsafe place, even before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. There are villages scattered across the region located far from each other. They have considerable distances from the cities too. That's why there wasn't a coherent rule over the villages and regions. The place used to be a hotbed of counter-revolutionaries and drug traffickers that would spread opioids across the country, making it unsafe. The former regime couldn't establish security there. Immediately after the war ended and the UN resolution was accepted, he took up responsibilities in the Quds force and continued relying on the people there too. He knew the ethnicities in every region better than they knew themselves.
Such is the legacy of a man who was present on all fronts. He was present for two-thirds of his 62 years on this earth until a single instant and a U.S. drone strike outside a Baghdad airport targeting his car. His funeral matched his legacy. His casket, together with his companions, toured Baghdad before takeoff for Iran. And in Iran, it went from Ahvaz to Tehran, Qom and Mashhad before being laid to rest in Kerman, where he grew up. Processions were in their millions and were not limited to Iran. That'll be it for this episode. Thanks for staying with us to review a man whose legacy has mattered to many in his life and death. Bye for now.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawa'id.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Ghazim, alayhi salam. As I'm sure you all know, Imam Musa al-Ghazim, alayhi salam, was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so it can be said that the blood running in the veins of Imam Musa al-Ghazim, alayhi salam, was the same blood as that of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa al-Ghazim, alayhi salam, was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the seal of prophethood, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. It has been seen in the history books, and the historians and biographers have written that after the martyrdom of the sixth divinely appointed imam, who was the father of Imam Musa al-Ghazim alayhi salam, it was Imam Musa al-Ghazim who managed the affairs of the scientific religious university of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, this religious scientific university is regarded as the first cultural foundation in Islam, and it is also considered the first institute from which a group of great scholars, on whose top were the imams of the Islamic schools of the Ahl al-Sunnah, for many of the imams of the different schools of thought and the maktabs and the madhabs of the Ahl al-Sunnah brothers actually attended, and perhaps one could say graduated, from this religious scientific university of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, this religious scientific university that was now under the head of Imam Musa al-Ghazim alayhi salam played a critical role in developing the intellectual life and the growing of the scientific religious movement of the time of Imam Musa al-Ghazim alayhi salam. It lasted for many times, conveying the spirit, guidance, and the message of Islam. And it was under Imam Musa al-Ghazim alayhi salam that this religious scientific university strengthened and continued and aimed at spreading awareness and bringing about an intellectual renaissance. These, dear friends, are the dialogues of Imam al-Ghazim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: تستحب عرامة الغلام في صغره ليكون حليما في كبره.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "It is recommended to discipline a boy in his childhood in order that he be clement as an adult."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the different conversations of Imam al-Ghazim alayhi salam that he emphasized the Muslims to obtain a understanding in the religion of Allah, to obtain an understanding in Islam, and he urged and encouraged and recommended that the Muslims also obtain understanding and knowledge of the religious precepts, the precepts of Islam. And so, of course, we find that Imam al-Ghazim alayhi salam therefore encouraged as much as he could
this obtainment of knowledge, because there is so much hidden in this obtainment of the understanding and knowledge of Islam. In one such conversation, he said to his companion, "The superiority of a learned man over mere worshippers is like the superiority of the sun over the stars." And so, dear friends, as we know that the sun just completely overwhelms, encompasses, and takes over all these other small little stars in the sky, so thus the learned man is like a sun over mere worshippers who are like stars. Now, if we think about this idea a little bit, of course, an individual who is a mere worshipper, a person who worships Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, without proper knowledge, of course, that kind of a worship is per se not a very strong type of a worship. So let me just give an example. If I were to worship Allah without knowing who He is, then that worship is not as perhaps valuable or spiritual as a worship of somebody who does know Allah. An individual who knows Allah, knows His divine attributes, knows and believes firmly in the being of Allah, that individual's worship is truly much more different than an individual who just worships because they believe they need to worship. For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first divinely appointed Imam, says that, "O Allah, I worship You not out of greed for paradise, nor do I worship You out of the fear of hell. Rather, I worship You because I found You worthy of worship." And so, the learned man is truly a sun over the mere worshippers who are stars. The encouragement to obtain knowledge and understanding of the religion of Allah, of Islam. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Now, I just wanted to point out to the intellectual aspect of the Imam. There's a very beautiful hadith, a very long hadith from Hisham ibn Hakam, one of the greatest theologians. There's a lot of things to mention in regards to him as well, and how he debated, how he challenged great scholars by going to Baghdad, by going to different Basra, by going to different places, and he challenged them. And he promoted the phenomena, the ideology, or the thought of imamat and wilayat, you know, by defeating them, right? Like that famous, in that big masjid of Baghdad, that he goes, a great scholar sitting on the pulpit, and he's explaining, and then he says, "I have few simple questions to ask. You know, what do you do with your ear? What do you do with your eyes? What do you do with your mouth?" You know, the scholar was saying, "What are you, you know, why are you asking these questions?" He said, why don't you answer it?" And eventually pointing out to where does this all commands come from. All of these commands comes from the aql. So aql is that, you know, reality of imamat. You know, how can this whole creation be left without that sort of intellectual reality where the whole creation is guided towards, whether this little creation of our is guided by our aql the same way. Then that's how he introduced imamat in big gatherings.
Thank you. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.